News. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. If there's one thing the majority of Americans can agree on, it's the corrupting influence of money and politics. A few years ago, CBS conducted a poll about Americans' perception of government. The report said, quote, Americans see their leaders in Washington as overpaid agents of wealthy individuals and corporations who are largely disconnected from the concerns of average Americans, end quote. 80% of those surveyed said they oppose the 2010 Supreme Court Citizens United decision, which opened the door to an unfettered, unregulated influx of money into elections by super PACs and a very small wealthy network of donors. For example, in this election season, the Koch brothers are estimated to spend $900 million. That's $500 million more than the Republican National Committee spent in 2012. In their new book, Wendell Potter and Nick Penniman, authors of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It, write, quote, American democracy has become coin-operated. Special interest groups increasingly control every level of government. The necessity of raising huge sums of campaign cash has completely changed the character of politics and policymaking, determining what elected representatives stand for and how they spend their time. The marriage of great wealth and intense political influence has rendered our country unable to address our most pressing problems, end quote. So how has big money changed our relationship with politics and policymaking, and what is the path to reform? Today, we're joined by Wendell Potter, senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity. He's also a leading critic of the health insurance industry. Wendell Potter spent 20 years as a senior executive for health insurance companies. You might remember that in 2009, after he left the industry, he told a Senate committee that he saw how the insurance companies confuse their customers and dump sick people so they can satisfy their Wall Street investors. Tonight, Wendell Potter and Nick Penniman, who will be joining us in about 20 minutes, are speaking at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And Wendell Potter joins me in studio. Hi, Wendell. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, Rose. Good to be back.
It's great to have you back. So I remember when you left Aetna and you came on our show and you talked about why you left and how disgusted you felt with the insurance company because, as you say, they dump sick people so they can satisfy their Wall Street investors. What has that journey been like for you, and how did you come from that experience to writing a book about money and politics?
You know, Rose, excuse me, when I decided to leave the industry, I was pretty scared. I had worked in the industry, as you noted, for 20 years, and I know what they do for critics and how they try to silence their critics. So I went. I approached this with a lot of fear, but it's been very rewarding. After that Senate testimony, my life did change. Fortunately, it changed for the better in many ways. I have an entirely new group of friends doing things that are incredibly different. I've had a chance to write now 3 books, write columns for the Center for Public Integrity, and do a lot of public speaking.
And, of course, there's major connections between money and politics and the health insurance industry.
Right.
But you also, in this book, you write about the banks. You write about, and we'll talk about this, these call centers near Capitol Hill where both Democrats and Republicans go to raise money.
Right.
So why did you decide to focus so much on the influence of money in politics?
You know, during the health care reform debate, it became very clear to me that the work that I used to do in the industry – the strategies that I helped to write and to implement was being implemented in ways that would profit the insurance companies. People don't realize that the Affordable Care Act does a lot of good, I think. But first and foremost, it had to meet the expectations, the demands, if you will, of the big vested special interest in particular the pharmaceutical industry, but also the hospitals, also the insurance companies. So it became very clear to me that we couldn't get any more than we got because of the influence of those big industries. And I began talking to Nick about this, and we decided to look at other industries as well, too. And it's very clear that regardless of what the industry is, they have inordinate influence on Capitol Hill and in the state capitals as well.
And this money in politics affects everything from the food we eat to the air we breathe.
That's right. Exactly right. We look at five industries in the book, in the middle part of the book, to show we try to connect the dots for people to show how we are affected in our daily lives by big money in politics. I think Americans are certainly aware of the role of big money in politics, but I don't think we stop to think just how adversely we are affected.
Right. Talk a little bit more about that, because we do so many shows about the influence of money in politics, the effect of Citizens United. You write about the McCutcheon decision. And I often wonder if people do realize just how huge this has become. I mean, the fact that in order to run in a competitive House district, you have to raise between $10,000 to $15,000 every day.
That's right. I think people are generally aware of it, but they don't really understand the extent of it. And that's one of the things we tried to do with Deadly Spin, with Nation on the Take, was to describe exactly how it affects us and just how pervasive it is. Yeah, members of Congress on the House side spend about half their time at least every single day, not in their offices, not attending to constituent services, not on the House floor, not in committees. They're in call centers. It's hard to wrap your head around that. They actually go out of their offices, walk a few blocks to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the Republican Campaign Committee, and they sit at cubicles and they dial for dollars day in and day out.
Why haven't we heard about this? I mean, we've done so many shows about money in politics. I have never heard of these call centers. And in your book, Nation on the Take, you report that NPR tried to get access to these call centers for a story on fundraising in 2012, but got no further than a description of them from members of Congress. Former Representative Dennis Cardoza, a California Democrat, compared his party's call center to a sweatshop with 30-inch wide cubicles set up for the sole purpose of begging for money. He said the need for constant fundraising helped push him into retirement. Peter DeFazio, a Democrat from Oregon, told NPR that if you walked in, you'd say, "This is the worst-looking, most abusive-looking call situation I've seen in my life. These people don't have any workspace. The other person is virtually touching them."
Right. We don't know about that because, for one thing, the parties don't give the media access to those call centers. As you read there, NPR was not able to get inside to actually see for themselves what it's like. They had to go on the accounts of members of Congress. The other thing, though, is that there aren't many reporters who even try to get as far as NPR tried to do. I was a reporter in Washington many years ago, and I spend a lot of time there now. Reporters just they become part of the wallpaper, and they report on the horse races, the he said, she said, of what's going on Capitol Hill without really explaining to the American public what really goes on there.
And that's what we're getting with election coverage, but we'll talk about that later in the show. But back to these call centers. Former Representative Walt Minnick, a conservative Democrat from Iowa, won his election to Congress in 2008. He took just 5 days off before heading back to the phones. He said he had to raise between $10,000 to $15,000 every day because his district is considered competitive, and he knew that he would face a tough re-election.
Right.
How common is this, $10,000 to $15,000 a day?
Oh, that's average. That's not unusual at all. Most members of Congress are expected to raise that much money because it's a constant campaign for them. They're elected, and then they're immediately beginning to raise money for their reelection. So it's ongoing. Even if they're not in competitive districts, they are expected to do that by their party leaders to raise money for other candidates or those that might not be as successful, particularly committee chairs. If you are chairing a committee, you are more likely than other members of Congress to be able to get money from the big industries that you're supposedly regulating or at least have some jurisdiction over.
How is this money spent? Because we talk about money in politics. We talk about Bernie Sanders raising millions and millions of dollars from small donors. Hillary Clinton is having a dinner with Amal and George Clooney at a venture capitalist home in San Francisco. And if you've got $353,000 as a couple, you can have dinner with them. But we don't really hear much about how that money is spent. We hear about the strategists, the TV ads, the people that they put in there on their team to come up with ads, but where does that the $10,000 to $15,000 a day go?
Well, it goes to developing campaign strategies to developing TV ads or radio ads or online ads. Online ads have become popular, of course. It goes to pay salaries of staff people, headquarters. It goes to pay you name it. Anything that can help someone get reelected, the money goes there.
Today I'm speaking with Wendell Potter about his new book, Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. You also report on the welcoming package that newly elected Democrats are given when they go to Washington, and it basically gives them a model daily schedule: 4 hours of call time, 1 to 2 hours of constituent visits, 2 hours of committee hearings on or floor votes, 1 hour of strategic outreach. So call time and strategic outreach, we can guess,
yeah,
is
that's all
for
fundraising.
Money.
That's all dialing for dollars. Exactly right. So as you see there, they are now spending more time raising money than they are serving the constituents, the people who vote for them.
Wendell Potter is co-author of Nation on the Take, and now I would like to welcome Wendell's co-author, Nick Penniman. Nick is executive director of the organization Issue One, and he was previously publisher of the Washington Monthly and director of the Huffington Post Investigative Fund. Hi, Nick. Thanks
Hi.
For coming in.
Thank you very much.
I know
good
you
to
just,
see you.
You just landed,
yes.
So we're glad to see you here.
Thanks.
I was talking with Wendell about these call centers, and I'm kind of shocked that I have never learned about this, because we've done so many shows about money and politics. And so these call centers are very not too far from Capitol Hill, and Democrats and Republicans use them to dial for dollars endlessly. In some cases, they have to raise 10 to 15 grand a day. What went through your mind when you heard about this?
I first heard about it actually from a congresswoman from the Northeast, who was telling me about what it was like to sit in the call center in these cubicles and dial for dollars for 4 hours a day. And she said, you know, Nick, she said, because I'm a woman, I think it's strange, because I think people will actually ask me questions or say stuff to me that they wouldn't say to a man. And I said, well, give me an example, Congresswoman blank. And she said, okay, so I was on the phone the other day, and I was calling a Hollywood executive who I had never met before to ask him for money. And I got his wife on the phone, and I said, hi, I'm Congresswoman so-and-so. I was wondering if I could talk to your husband. I'm looking to see if he'd be willing to support my – and this woman, the wife, lit into a tirade about the fact that she had just received these curtains in the mail that were the wrong color of yellow. They're supposed to be lemon yellow, but they're more like mustard yellow, and she can't believe it. And thank God someone finally called, because
– and she so here, to vent.
Yeah, so here you have a member of Congress – having to wade through the tirade of a wealthy Hollywood woman just to be able to get to the point where she can say, actually, I'm looking for money for my campaign.
And did she give money?
And apparently she finally got to the husband, and the husband wrote a check. But that's what we're asking our elected representatives to do. They have to live through that just to be able to keep their jobs.
In your book, you write that NPR tried to get access to these call centers in 2012, but they were denied. And we were talking about why reporters don't write more about this. I mean, the cynics among us, and sometimes I'm one of them, will say, well, a lot of that money goes to the corporate media to play ads during election time. I mean, it's a windfall. You had CBS CEO Les Moonves say, keep out going, Donald. We love what's happening here because you're making us so much money.
Yeah. I don't know why they don't cover it more. And in my mind, it's really one of the least covered aspects of money in politics. People write about the Koch brothers. They write about Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate who's contributing a lot of money to campaigns. They write about super PACs. But the reality of it is that this is the bulk of fundraising. This is half of how they spend their time. And it's completely demeaning for them. They hate it. Most of the political funders are fed up with it because they're maxing out to all these politicians. And it's the very thing that draws them away from paying attention to the issues that we all care about.
And so this is just House members. What about senators?
Senators, it's even worse. It's even worse because they've got to raise so much more. I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly. They don't have to go maybe spend that many hours a day because they have six-year terms. But they have to spend. They have to raise a lot of money because they run statewide races, and the people who donate to these candidacies are usually lobbyists or executives of big corporations that will want something down the road.
Right. I was going to ask you, I mean, in addition to the Hollywood moguls, who else is receiving these phone calls? Because you report that when you look at the 2008, 2010, and 2012 election cycles, AT&T has 88% Hill coverage, meaning 88% of members of Congress have received contributions from AT&T sources. That can also mean employees. Honeywell International, 88%. UPS, 88%. Lockheed Martin, 80%. Comcast, General Electric, Boeing, and Verizon all have about 70%.
Yeah, it is remarkable how hard the large corporations play this game. And where typically the members are raising money directly from the lobbyists and corporate executives of the interests that they're supposed to be regulating based on their committee assignments. So if you're on the finance committee, you're spending most of your time trying to raise money from bank lobbyists and bank executives. In fact, last year, the House Financial Services Committee raised $30 million in $2,700 increments, by the way, because that's what's called the hard money cap, $30 million directly from bank lobbyists and bank executives. In almost any other sector of society, that type of activity would be considered such a deep conflict of interest that it would be banned immediately. But in Washington, it's the way the game is played.
You also take a look at the top 20 recipients of financial sector contributions. Now, definitely Republicans dominate, but not by much, because I wanted to ask you, what is the difference now between Democrats and Republicans? So when you look at 2013 and 2014, this is according to the Center for Responsive Politics, Democratic Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, who's like the rising young star in the Democratic Party, is getting the most from the financial sector, $4.1 million. He's getting more than Senate Republican Mitch McConnell. He's at $3.7 million. And House member John Boehner, who's at $3.2 million. So again, Cory Booker, Democrat from New Jersey, is at the very top of the list with $4.1 million.
Yeah, and if you look at the contributions for the pharmaceutical industry, he's number two there as well, too. He takes in a lot of money. Yeah, he's perceived as the young star. But the point here is that these companies are very bipartisan.
Right.
They contribute to candidates on both sides of the political aisle. And it's very important. When I was at Cigna, one of my responsibilities was administering the Political Action Committee. And we would look to see who the committee chairs are and who is in power. If the Republicans are in power, more than likely you'll contribute more to the Republican Party. If the Democrats are, it'll shift because you will want to make sure that you are contributing to those who have power, who are committee chairs.
Yeah, I'll never forget. This was a couple years before Wendell and I decided to do this book. I was talking to a lobbyist at a very large lobbying firm in D.C. called Patton Boggs, the name of the firm, and and I said to the guy that I was talking to, I said, "So you really straddle the fence with your campaign contributions? You've got to give to Democrats and Republicans." And he got this huge smirk on his face, and he said, "I don't straddle the fence. I go right through the fence." It's just enough to make you want
to
bludgeon someone.
Exactly. The real power in Washington is not on the Capitol Hill or the White House. It's on K Street, which is kind of halfway between them.
Well, and in many cases, these lobbying firms are started by both Democrats and Republicans.
Oh, yeah.
So they have access to both sides.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And you also report in your book, by 2014, nearly 9 out of 10 Citigroup lobbyists were former government staffers for Democrats and Republicans. So is there any difference between the Dems and the Republicans when it comes to money in politics?
No.
And we know the Kochs definitely give more to Republicans.
Right.
Yeah, the big difference is that there were some major Republican donors like the Koch Network and Sheldon Adelson are playing the super PAC game and the dark money game, which is 501c4 organizations, dark money organizations. They're playing that more aggressively than the Democrats are.
Right.
So they outstrip the Democrats when it comes to that kind of spending, but there's parity once you balance it all out between super PACs, dark money, and hard money. There's total parity between the two parties in terms of the amount of money that they're raising and spending.
Would you say there's more parity at the national level? Because at the state level, Democrats got creamed in the last few elections, and even the moderate Republicans said they were shocked when they looked at how much money the Tea Party candidates got and support they got from the Koch network.
Well, they also get money from not just the Koch network, but from other corporate interests as well too. The Koch brothers make the headlines, but there are a lot of corporate givers as well that fill the coffers for these organizations.
You know, and when it comes to the Democratic Party being so so involved in the game, it's worth pointing out, as we write in the book, that this began a long time ago, and actually began with the creation of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership mm-hmm. Council, which was founded by Bill Clinton and Al Gore and a bunch of Southern moderate Democrats who saw in the 1980s that union money was going to be drying up as a source of income for the Democratic Party. And as a result, they knew they had to supplant that, or they thought they had to supplant that, with other forms of money. So they started going to the industries that typically the Democratic Party never would have gone to. And they started with pharma, and they started with Wall Street and large media companies and health insurance companies, basically the industries that they thought weren't terribly odious. They didn't want to go to extractive industries like coal and oil or to manufacturing, but they thought that finance and healthcare and media would be fine. And they started snorting that money. And as a result, they developed a strong addiction to it, so much so that, as many of your listeners probably know, it was the Democrats who actually deregulated Wall Street in the late 90s, which led to the financial collapse of 2008.
Well, let's take a call before we go to break. Let's hear from Bill in New Mexico. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got two quick questions. One is about the impact of when Obama rejected matching funds in July of 2008. And in my opinion, Wall Street reform and holding Wall Street accountable was doomed at that point. And the second question has to do, when did political operatives like Karl Rove start taking a cut out of the advertising for the campaigns they managed? Because all of a sudden they went from making a few million a year to making 40 or 50 million a year.
Well, I'll take the second question because I've got a personal anecdote about it. This guy in my neighborhood bought up a huge house, the biggest house in the neighborhood. He was probably 32 at the time, and knocked the back of it off and was expanding the house, doubling the size of the house. And he's got a big, shiny BMW outside. And I walked up to him, and this is in Washington, D.C., and I walked up to him and I said, "Hey, man, how you doing? What's going on?" I said, "You're really pumping a lot of money into your house." He said, "Yeah, yeah." And I said, "Just curiously, what do you do for a living?" And he smiled and he said, "Oh, I do ad buys." And he was on the team that did the ad buys for Obama, and Obama spent $1 billion.
Wow.
And yeah, when they're making 10% of that, and when the firm makes 10%, they make money hand over fist. And it used to not be that way. It used to be that when you got involved in a political campaign, you were couch surfing, you were doing it almost as an act of volunteerism, and you were taking a financial hit because of it, with the hope that if your candidate won, you'd get some kind of position. Now it's just a means of getting rich.
Since you're on Obama, I just want to ask you what you think he means when he says things like, there aren't a lot of functioning democracies around the world that work this way, where you can have millionaires and billionaires bankrolling whoever they want, however they want, in some cases undisclosed. So he criticizes the influence of money in politics, but he benefited tremendously from the influx of money flowing into his campaign. So what do you think about that?
Well, he's right in what he says, but he doesn't do a lot in terms of addressing the problem, which is regrettable. There's no doubt about that. And yeah, he did, as the caller suggested, he did not accept matching funds, which is that too is regrettable.
And the Democrats' argument is always, well, we have to run against these Republicans who have endless amounts of money, so we have no choice.
It's an arms race. There's no doubt about it. And as Nick was saying, it started during the Clinton administration when they began to shift to corporations. And one of the reasons Washington has become so expensive and such a different kind of city these days is because of all this money and the cottage industries, the ad buyers that Nick was mentioning. They're making a ton of money, and a lot of that is going to coming from special interests.
We point out in the book that that lobbyists last year, and by the way, there are 12,000 registered lobbyists in Washington. When Kennedy was elected, there were 250. There are now 12,000 registered lobbyists in Washington. Last year, they disclosed $2.6 billion in expenditures. That's just what they were required to disclose by law. So guess how much it costs to run Congress? $2 billion. So $600 million more was spent in Washington last year trying to influence Congress than it cost to actually operate Congress.
And it's not just Congress. It's the executive branch, too, the regulatory agencies. A lot of money that lobbyists spend goes to influence the regulation that happens in Washington as well, too.
Today, I'm speaking with Wendell Potter and Nick Penniman, co-authors of the new book, Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. After the break, we will talk about how we got here. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling our toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or if you would rather write than call, the email address, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd rather, you can also just post your comment at yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. And following that at 12 today, John Perry, Ken Taylor, and this week's edition of Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss plans to export coal from Utah to Oakland. In an attempt to save Utah's declining coal industry, the state approved a $53 million loan to build a terminal in West Oakland. Utah wants to reach overseas markets. Supporters there say it'll protect jobs in Utah, bring new jobs to Oakland. Opponents are critical of the environmental costs and the legality of the deal. We're talking about that tomorrow. Thursday, we're going to talk about all of the voting problems we have seen across the country. Yesterday, there was a pretty nasty hearing on election fraud in the Arizona primary. You probably have heard that in the most populated county in Arizona, Maricopa County, they cut the number of polling places from 200 to 60, and thousands of people stood in line for 5 hours. One person was arrested yesterday. So we're going to talk about why this is happening in the year 2016. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm speaking with Wendell Potter and Nick Penniman about their new book, Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. And Nick and Wendell will be speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Wendell Potter is a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity. He spent 20 years as a senior exec for health insurance companies. After he left the industry, he told a Senate committee in 2009 that he saw how the insurance companies dump sick people so they can satisfy their Wall Street investors. And Nick Penniman is executive director of the organization Issue One. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about money and politics? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from Joan in Oakland. Hi, Joan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. In the UK, politicians are forbidden to forbidden from advertising on TV and radio. And to me, that would make a lot more difference than changing campaign finance regs, because I think most of the money does go into advertising. And I know there are First Amendment arguments, but I think it's a misreading of the First Amendment, that the First Amendment really means our right to get information and not someone else's right to shove information down our throats.
Well, thank you, Joan. I've been wanting to do a show about how all of this works in other countries. What do you both think of that? In the UK, advertising is forbidden.
Well, we could learn a lot from other countries. They have shorter campaign periods as well, too.
Right.
I think it's pretty doubtful that we would follow their lead in those areas, but I think there certainly are some things that we could look at those other countries and try to model.
I was surprised to learn that Canada's election takes less than 3 months. Most of us had never heard of Justin Trudeau before he won, and it's because it took 3 months.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, most people didn't realize that they were even having an election
right.
in Canada because it was so short.
pretty hard to mess with our election cycle, though. I mean, the state of New Hampshire has it enshrined in their constitution that they have to be the first in the country primary. So so you'd have to move every state, basically, which I don't think that they want to do. I think they actually enjoy the attention. I know my friends in New Hampshire certainly enjoy the attention that they get. So I think it's hard. It's hard to shrink the length of the campaign season down in America.
Well, thank you for calling in, Joan. We'll still think about doing a show about that issue. Let's go next to Craig. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I initially wrote the local party building resolution, which passed at the DNC about 10 years ago. And basically, it would give more power to the local party organizations, which is sort of the flip side of these big corporate contributions. But unfortunately, it wasn't worth the paper it was written on because no money was spent on local party building. So recently I've been thinking that one solution might be putting a tax on candidates so that money would go into local grassroots organizing. If there was like a 5% tax, you know, this would be enough money. I live in Alameda County. Your guest is going to be speaking at the Hillside Club in Berkeley. Alameda County has 600,000 Democrats. They have a website and a P.O. box. No type of organization, a church, a union, a corporation, or, you know, any sort of groups would have such a small organization. And that's because we have this candidate-centered system. One other thing in terms of, like, the election campaign, we have a long, long election campaign because it gives the candidates more time to raise money from special interest groups and for those special interest groups to have more control over our elected officials, except for Bernie, of course.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot there. The way to fix this problem, there are four things that you've got to do. Unfortunately, there isn't a single silver bullet. But the game changer, the true game changer, is what's called public financing of campaigns. In our minds, the best model right now is in New York City, where there's it's called a matching funds model, in which every contribution up to $175 is matched 6-to-1 by a public fund. So all of a sudden, a $50 donor starts looking like a $350 donor to a politician. And when you look at the political giving maps pre and post the inauguration of that system, pre, all of the giving in New York City came from the Upper East Side and Upper West Side, basically $2,000, $3,000 plate dinners, wealthy people. Post, all of a sudden, all the boroughs lit up. And politicians started talking about how, number one, they were spending less time raising money, and number two, when they were doing it, instead what they were doing is going back to their neighborhoods and holding barbecues for $25 a head. So that's the thing that will actually shift political power in this country back to the people, is to have the people finance politics, very akin to what we're seeing with Bernie's campaign. But that's the thing. It's, you know, those who pay the piper call the tune.
Right.
And unless we're all paying the pipers, then we're not going to have a chance to call the tune.
Talk a little bit more about this. How does public matching really work?
So
matching funds.
It exists in about 20 different states. The funding typically comes from all different places. So in New York City, it comes right out of the general fund. In Connecticut, it comes from abandoned and seized property, you know, which is a very non-controversial source of financing. So it wasn't hard to get that done. But the deal is that when you – in New York, for instance, when you enter the system, you agree that you will not accept contributions above $175 as a politician, and therefore the match kicks in, the 6-to-1 match kicks in. So as I said, what it does is it incentivizes them to go after the little dollars as opposed to the big dollars. The other really interesting thing about it is that many studies have proven that those who contribute financially to campaigns, even if it's only $5, are much more engaged citizens. They're bird-dogging and watching the behavior of their candidate, and they're making phone calls to their candidate too when they're upset. So it actually increases participation because you're literally bought into the process. So that's what, you know, when Wendell and I advocate solutions, there are other realms of solutions around transparency and lobbying and fixing the Federal Election Commission. But in our minds, that's the big one.
It's very, very important because a lot of people just are cynical.
Yep.
They don't vote. They don't think their vote makes a difference. And that's very dangerous to our democracy as well, too. So it's a very important thing to address just to try to get more citizen involvement.
Well, as exciting as this campaign has been so far, depending on where you stand, not many people are voting. in the primaries.
Not enough.
It's a small percentage when you look at the states that have already voted.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to public matching funds in these 20 states, is it voluntary? If I run for office, I can choose whether or not to take part in this.
Yeah, it's voluntary. If we had a magic wand, we would just say that it should be mandatory.
Right, because then if I'm running against someone who's maybe independently wealthy and has a lot of wealthy friends, I still don't have a chance.
Yeah. Well, you do, though. Who knows, right? I mean, maybe you do, depending upon how good you are at a ground game and at raising small donations, et cetera, et cetera.
So do you have a percentage? How many people actually take part in this matching fund program in these 20 states?
Don't know. Don't know the answer to that. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to look at that.
Yeah.
And to find out, is it giving someone more of a chance who otherwise wouldn't have a chance?
Yeah. Well, we certainly know in Connecticut and Maine, where there also is a public financing program, that many, many people who are now in the state legislature and in the city council have said that they never would have run or never would have been able to run otherwise. So it certainly is increasing the level of political participation on behalf of the candidates, with school teachers and plumbers and people who, you know, the founding fathers originally thought would be running the country. It wasn't supposed to just be the moneyed elite.
And in those places, people know who their employees are, the people they vote for. They know the member of Congress or representative. They know the state legislator or the city council person. In other parts of the country, people don't even know who represents them.
Right. Well, and then when you look at judges, people have no idea who judges are. And you've got really interesting information in your book. This is starting to get more attention because so much money is being poured into these races across the country. So you report that Americans elect judges in 39 states, including state Supreme Court justices. Between 2000 and 2014, these judges raised $275 million, according to Politico. That means many judges are making the kinds of solicitations and phone calls to well-financed individuals and interests that our lawmakers make in Capitol Hill call centers. In the 2012 election cycle, outside spending in judicial races almost doubled from the previous cycle.
Right.
Why is this happening?
Well, take West Virginia, for example, or a coal state where the coal companies want to make sure that if there's litigation that goes before a judge, that they'll more than likely have a judge with a friendly ear.
And that happened.
It happens.
Yeah, it also happened in North Carolina. A Republican justice, and it's absurd that a state Supreme Court justice should even be called a Republican justice or a Democratic justice or anything, right? But he was running for re-election. A Democratic challenger emerged who looked like he was actually going to win the election. The Republican justice was very friendly to tobacco interests. And when the tobacco companies got wind of this, they formed – R.J. Reynolds led the way. They formed a PAC. They pumped $1 million into the PAC. These races normally typically cost about $100,000. They pump $1 million into this PAC, flood the race, and make sure that the Democrat gets suppressed, knocked out, and that the pro-tobacco Republican justice stays in. So corporations are now realizing that the courts are fair game for their activity. And that, you know, if that doesn't scare the pants off of every American, I don't know what does.
You cite a study from Justice at Stake, a poll in which 93% of respondents said judges should not hear cases involving major campaign supporters. But as it stands right now, that's legal?
That's legal. It's up to the justice, of course, to recuse him or herself from the case. But who's really watching that, right?
It happens once in a while in the Supreme Court.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely absurd. I mean, Sandra Day O'Connor, who, as many people know, was appointed by Reagan, thinks that there should never be – no judge should be elected to office and should have to raise money to get on the bench.
And the Supreme Court has a lot of attention focused on it. A lot of these judges and lower-level courts, the media pays no attention to what's going on.
And they're so important, these decisions that come down. Did anything else stand out for you when you looked at the influence of money on judges?
Just how aggressively corporations really in the last 5 years are starting to play in that realm, right? Because they know that they're not going to get watched, and they know that if they can affect activity at the appellate court level, then they can win a lot of victories and establish judicial precedent that is extremely friendly to them and make sure that as a result, you never the wrong cases never get up to the Supreme Court, the wrong cases meaning right. cases that would negatively affect them.
Nick Penniman and Wendell Potter are co-authors of the book Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. They're speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about the role that money plays in politics? What are your thoughts on reform? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Nick Penniman is executive director of the organization Issue One. Wendell Potter is a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity. After 20 years as a senior executive for the health insurance companies, he left and talked about how insurance companies confuse customers and dump sick people so they can satisfy their Wall Street investors. You've got some also interesting information in your book about the history of money in politics. You write that this issue goes back to the early 20th century. In 1907, Teddy Roosevelt signed into law the first campaign finance law, and it stipulated in the law regarding reducing the influence of money in politics. What did you learn about that?
Well, what we learned is no great revelation probably to many of your listeners, but because we're living in the second Gilded Age, we're dealing with very similar problems that emerged in the first Gilded Age, which is exactly what Roosevelt was dealing with. So, you know, when Roosevelt came into office in the early 1900s, he was facing excessive wealth in this country that was aggregating at the top, massive trusts or monopolies that were forming in various industries, including oil, railroads, and banking. And a dissatisfied and disenchanted electorate that felt as if they had no longer had any power. Roosevelt, as we all know, was a tremendous reformer, probably one of the best reforming presidents we've ever had. If he was running today, he'd be running to the left of Bernie. And he knew that to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish in terms of busting up the trusts, in terms of restoring integrity to the democratic process, he had to start with campaign finance reform. So he rammed through, in his Teddy Roosevelt way, a thing called the Tillman Act in 1907, which was the first law to ban corporate contributions directly to political campaigns. And that, in many ways, began got the ball rolling on campaign finance reform throughout the course of the 20th century. And so here we are again in a situation in which we've got a massive aggregation of wealth at the top. We've got corporations that are continuing to conglomerate and form monopolies and oligopolies. And, you know, I certainly what you're hearing from Bernie is that and from I think others, too, is that it's time again for us to de-rig the system so that we can begin returning power to all of us.
And it's not just Bernie and the Democrats. We're hearing this and seeing this on the Republican side, too. It's worth noting that Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican, of course, a lot of conservative groups or conservative former politicians and scholars and even leaders of the Tea Party movement understand that things are not quite right and are very much involved in this movement.
You report that in 1910, congressional Republicans passed additional campaign finance laws. It restricted campaign spending and required political parties to report their donations, but only after the election had occurred.
Yeah, there's always a twist, or often a twist, with these types of laws. It was unfortunate. You know, right now, for instance, with super PACs, they don't have to disclose their givers until after the election also. There's a time window they have to disclose, but the bulk of their spending occurs in the last month, and they don't have disclosed until after that. So it seems like there's often a little trick with these laws. But listen, for 100 years, this country and the Supreme Court upheld the notion that money, the flow of money in and around politics, was the flow of property primarily, not speech, and that as a result, it had to be regulated to limit both corruption and the appearance of corruption. And the appearance of corruption from a jurisprudence perspective is just as operative a term as actual or real corruption. Even the Rehnquist Court upheld all of this. And Rehnquist certainly thought of himself as being a constitutionalist and an originalist. So it wasn't until 2010, until Roberts emerged and Kennedy wrote the Citizens United decision, that this concept of money as speech and corporations as political actors became full blown. But it's an utter distortion of and an aberration. The way that you know, for 100 years, the courts considered it.
And poll after poll shows that the overwhelming majority of the population opposes Citizens United, for example. They want big money out of politics. And you cite that Princeton study that came out a couple of years ago that found the public is to the left on healthcare, education, abortion, and yet politicians are not acting on those issues because of money in politics. And so even the Princeton study said that this is not a democracy. So given that, and given that the fact that people are really cynical about this issue, how do you begin to challenge it and dismantle it? You do write about a number of Citizens United resolutions that are passing at the local level, but then what?
Well, you're seeing that at the local level. You're seeing a lot of activity at the local level. We write about members of the Tea Party and liberals in Tallahassee, Florida, coming together, for example, to do something about the corruption in local politics in that community. So you're seeing things happening. And in South Carolina, the lobbyists cannot make campaign contributions in the state.
And are those rules enforced? Because we know that, you write, the FEC is barely doing its job, the Federal Elections Commission.
Yeah, they are enforced. And so you're seeing the beginnings of a movement where the last chapter in the book is about, the makings of an all-American movement. It is beginning. People, I think what we need, and Nick and I recognize this, is a bigger army of citizens to be engaged in this and to understand what's at stake. And that was the reason why we wrote the book in the first place.
Yeah, for way too long, this cause has been seen as the province of the left. Yeah. And that's very unfortunate because it really, if you think about all of the issues that are out there, this is the one that is truly an all-American issue. It sources back to the founding of the country. It sources back to whether or not we have a truly representative republic or not. We can disagree on policy on all levels, from environment to health to choice to guns, but because that's kind of Wendell and I call it the software. But the hardware is whether or not we have a representative republic, whether or not we can have a fair debate. And we, at this point, the hardware is irreparably broken. So the only people who are able to win are the ones basically who are able to not even get stuff done, but shut stuff down constantly in Washington. Right. And that's what we see. So, you know, Wendell and I go through five different industries in the book, five different issues, and we show systematically how each one of them, from the fight against obesity to the fight to reduce prescription drug costs to the fight to control fracking, et cetera, et cetera, all of those are being crippled and shut down by big money at this point. So what we're encouraging in the book is for people to have a common revelation that this is the one barricade that we all face. And unless we collectively come together to break it down, we're not going to get anything done.
What do you think about what Bernie Sanders' campaign has accomplished so far with very small donations? Vox is reporting for the second straight month Sanders relied on small donors to outraise Hillary Clinton, ranking in 14 million more in February. Sanders has received $77 million from those giving less than $200. Clinton has received $32 million from the same category. The rest of the money that she has raised is from people giving the max of $2,700. Bernie won overwhelmingly in Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii, and he raised a lot of money since those wins on Saturday. What do you think of that campaign? Because this is his main issue, money in politics.
It is. It's the centerpiece of his campaign, and I think it's really remarkable to see how people have been attracted to his candidacy, and it shows that there are people who want to donate. They are paying attention to the campaign, and it can be done. And keep in mind, he is a self-described socialist, and he's getting that kind of support and that kind of money.
It's that kind of financing is exactly the kind of financing that we want to see across the spectrum. I mean, I'd be thrilled if Ted Cruz had that kind of financing too, frankly. That's exactly what we want to see. We want to see small donors dominating the situation and flooding out and diluting the effect of big donors.
And just one more cynical question. Yeah. What about people who say the parties don't want this, though, because the people in the top of the Democratic National Committee want Bernie gone? They want him out of the race. And they're not really tapping into all of the energy that he has created with this campaign.
And they may not like it, but he's not going to go away. And he's going to be a presence at the convention in Philadelphia, no doubt about it.
They also know that the fundraising race is exhausting everyone.
Right.
It's exhausting the politicians. It's exhausting the political donors. They're sick of it. They're maxing out. They're spending so much money on politics and not spending it on philanthropy. So they know that the treadmill is moving so fast right now that it's basically flinging everything off of it. And something's got to give. Listen, Howard Dean was the head of the DNC, as you recall, and he was the one who pioneered small donor financing in his presidential primary campaign. The DNC understands that there is an enormous amount of potential to begin tapping into small donors out there. They just need to seize it.
Yeah, and according to The Intercept, Howard Dean is now employed by a healthcare lobby firm.
He is. He is. And you can see his commentaries in the New York Times shilling for the pharmaceutical industry, unfortunately.
Okay, so final thoughts. It sounds like what's realistic, a Supreme Court justice that would work to overturn or at least favor overturning Citizens United, right? That's what Bernie Sanders talks about. Hillary Clinton said she also supports that. It sounds like public finance is also realistic at this point.
Yeah, and there are five ballot measures up this year in South Dakota and Arkansas and Washington State and elsewhere that would accomplish public financing systems plus do ethics reform plus transparency. As you noted earlier, there have been 600 anti-Citizens United resolutions have passed at the city council and state level since that decision came down. So as Wendell said, we are seeing an uprising, an American uprising, and it's occurring on the left and the right. People get it. They're fed up with the system, and they're ready to put other things aside to begin fighting.
Wendell Potter and Nick Penniman are authors of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. And they'll be speaking tonight at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Wendell and Nick, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss plans to export coal from Utah to Oakland. In an attempt to save Utah's declining coal industry, the state approved a $53 million loan to build a terminal in West Oakland. Through Oakland, Utah's coal will reach overseas markets. Supporters say it will protect jobs in Utah and bring new jobs to Oakland. Opponents are critical of the environmental costs and the legality of the deal. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
People think they know stuff, have their little theories, conjectures, beliefs, but when you're about to put everything on the line, there is no room for error. On the next Snap Judgment, we proudly present Proof. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Lynn Washington, Snap Judgment, tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. Today at 1, Big Picture Science from our friends at the SETI Institute in Mountain View. Coming up next, World Have Your Say from the BBC, and following that at noon is John Perry and Ken Taylor and Philosophy Talk. The time is 11 o'clock, and this is 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, a listener-supported community broadcast service. World Have Your Say from the BBC is next. The program was recorded earlier this morning for broadcast at this time.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say on the BBC. I'm Ben James. We'll start by talking about the plane hijack that's now over.
If you have a system which is dependent upon multiple levels and multiple different types of people servicing aircraft, obviously it's only as strong as its weakest link.
A passenger took over the Egyptair flight. It diverted to Cyprus. He claimed he was wearing an explosive belt. In the end, no one was hurt and all hostages released. But one question a lot of you are asking is, how is it possible to hijack a plane in a high-security era? You'll hear a pilot and psychologist discuss. Also, we'll talk to the man who was the first to tweet the hashtag BernieMadeMeWhite, making a point about the portrayal of the racial profile of Bernie Sanders supporters. And after a Twitter exchange about Nigerian expats involving a presidential aide, we'll talk to a group of them.